Welcome again to Wednesday morning. It's 11 a.m. In Central Time. We're on from 11 till 1. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and the program is Changing the Way We See the World. And we're on RBN Live today, and as we are every Wednesday at this time, for a couple hours, talking about technologies and what's happening in that whole area. You know, over the last several weeks, we've covered a lot of different topical material. I'm sorry I missed everyone last week, and we had to run a replay, but we're back. And the issue today I want to get into a little bit is personal privacy. And I want to start with actually an article. It's a July 25th article this year, and it's on it's called License Plate Tracking for All, and it's in on the Wired news service, and it's discussion of a new method for tracking vehicles. It was a device developed by Virginia-based G2 Tactics, which is a manufacturer of the technology. And what essentially it uses is it's an infrared camera that is used for looking at license plates. And so what it does is these cameras cost about $25,000 a piece right now. They're about the size of a can of beans. They're not real big. But they can actually scan rapidly and get 60 license plates per second and run them through central databases, which include FBI or state and local police files, to actually determine if any of those vehicles have wants, warrants, are stolen, you know, any of that kind of information. But this system isn't being limited, apparently not limited to law enforcement. There are no laws or regulations on collecting that kind of data. So the kinds of things it could be used is not just for tracking criminals, but actually tracking anyone. And what's going to happen with this technology, according to the article, three U.S. companies are pushing pretty hard for it, trying to get it deployed, not just for police departments and private companies, but they're using it, for instance, for parking authorities. One of the parking authorities in New Haven, Connecticut, deployed G2 Tactics LPR units and for parking violations. In the first 12 hours, they collected 120 cars and $40,000 in, I guess, parking fees. I guess it works. The point is the limit. And this is what the article kind of gets into is, you know, how could this be used? It could be used for tracking an errant spouse. It could be used for keeping up with your kids. It could be used for a lot of different things. And, you know, some of those things people might say, hey, that's not such a bad idea. Others we might find a little objectionable. And the thing that's happening here is they're also being, this is part of that whole discussion of data warehousing that we had some weeks ago. And I want to get back into that a little bit and explain what that means. You know, data warehousing, the storage of information is becoming increasingly easy and cheap to do. And that's what really drives it. I mean, when the cost of storing data gets so cheap that right today, for instance, on a square inch of media, the high-density media is used in security agencies and big companies, as well as our national security agencies, can store up to 1 million pages of data on a square inch of medium. You know, this kind of storage density means that you can store virtually everything on everyone very cheaply as these technologies continue to drop in price and computer power increases. And computing power, you know, is doubling about every 9 to 10 months. That's been happening consistently for a number of years now. That'll continue into the foreseeable future, as most people agree, maybe even accelerate, get faster and faster, as it appears to be doing. And as a consequence, not just tracking all of your movements, but how does that get integrated into other activity? One of the things that have been discussed, well, I hear the music. So when we come back up, we're going to talk about GPS tracking and taxing by the mile for every mile you drive. This new concept being kicked around a lot of parts of the country. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and we're headed for a break. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 in the morning till 1 p.m. Central Time. And today's topic, we're talking about personal privacy and some of the technologies surrounding that. We open with an article from Wired, and I was just getting into this issue of taxing by the mile. This is something that some states are actually looking at. And this is a method by which, you know, most cars now are built in with GPS. This is geographical positioning systems. These are systems that allow you to locate a vehicle, you know, very efficiently within a meter or so, or a few meters, a yard or two of its actual location. And they also, GPS is used in lots of different applications, you know, hikers in the woods, airplanes, obviously, navigation equipment, tracking freight through the country. You know, every trucker basically is aware that, you know, they're being tracked in terms of their movement across the country, so they know where the freight is, know where the driver is. All that is run through computers to track and make sure people are doing what they're supposed to be doing. But extending that beyond, say, tracking your freight across town is really what it's all about. And what they're thinking about doing is, instead of taxing people on road tax just by, say, the gasoline tax, which essentially is a per-mile tax, you know, based on your own personal taste and what kind of vehicle you want. So, you know, that's already sort of built in, but they're talking about tracking your movement, storing that data, calculating your miles, and sending you a tax bill for each mile you drive. And it's an interesting concept, and one that, needless to say, resulted in quite a bit of outcry. There was another attempt privately to use GPS systems, and it was for car rental agencies. And what they were doing with this technology is tracking road speeds, and you signed an agreement where you agreed if you exceeded the road speeds or did certain other driving violations that could be tracked with GPS, that you would pay additional charges. And so what they were doing, and this is where it ended, is it was debiting the poor guy's credit card as he sped down the highway, and before, when he got back to the car rental agency, he was zero on his account balance and in trouble with the agency. That went away, and we really haven't heard it come back in the last few years. But, you know, these are the concepts that these technologies allow. And whether it's, you know, tracking mileage, or whether it's tracking driving behaviors, you know, all of that may, in fact, be useful in some instances, but raises lots of questions in others. I mean, think about tracking your movements through cell phone traffic, you know, through your cell phone communications. People don't generally realize it, but all cell phones in the United States are required to have GPS built in. And it's for the 911 response, is what the excuse has been, for safety and security, for people's emergencies, so they can locate you in that kind of a situation. And the reality is, all that data is stored. It's been used since the late 90s in Europe for criminal prosecutions, beginning to be used in the U.S. where they have cause, they go in and get a warrant, and then they look backwards on people's traffic and movements and so on. And they also look at these and store the data, because clusters of communication, the things that the NSA has been monitoring, to and who and how you call to do certain things about people, activists show up really quickly, you know, not just criminals, but people who are engaged in activist work, some of which is totally permissible, like this conversation we're having on the radio today. And yet some elements of government might find it objectionable that we raise these issues and ask these questions. But the reality is, in this democratic republic, that's the privilege of living here and working here and being a citizen of this country, is the opportunity to raise these questions. The problems with personal privacy, something our founding fathers clearly understood, when it became the very first parts of our Bill of Rights. And, you know, when you look at personal privacy today in light of technology, the laws or regulation that restrict the misuse of this technology do not exist. In most municipalities, most counties, most states, and across the country nationally, the laws to restrict the misuse of personal information aren't there. So everything starts to get collected. I mean, we're starting out the day talking about where you drive and where you go. We're talking about cell phone traffic and the fact that those movements are also stored because it's cheap to do. When you start to go the next step, your credit cards, your medical records, your discount coupons at the grocery store, discount cards, checks, all the things that we do to transact our business, essentially are database-driven computer storage devices holding all of that data. And today, data valence is the word the European Parliament has coined in the late 90s. for this concept. In fact, we talk quite a bit about it in a book called Earth Rising, The Revolution, and then Earth Rising 2 on personal privacy, because in the late 90s, we started to see this huge trend. Europeans became a lot more concerned. You know, we just started hearing now, 6, 7, 8 years later in the U.S., increasing levels of concern over invasions of personal privacy by government. And it's interesting that in Europe, the place from which we ran, you know, 200 years ago, has a greater regard for personal privacy today than we do. Part of that is the recent experience. You know, our experiences of a few hundred years ago are many generations past. Yet today, those who have left, Eastern Europe or assisted in the collapse of Eastern Europe and the change of that regime, and those even around from when Western Europe was dominated by fascists. The fact of the matter is, people know that are breathing and living today what the loss of personal liberty means, and personal privacy is where all of that begins. You know, when you talk about technologies, many of these things serve us really well. And when we consider them, you know, often you hear this story, well, you know, personal privacy, if you have nothing to hide, don't worry about it. And that's true in most cases, except when you consider the fact that your government may not always be of the same mind as you. If you go back to the Nixon administration of now over 30 years ago, we saw the results of that for those that were alive then and the abuses of power that took place. The same kind of abuses of power taking place again today, whether it's the NSA's monitoring of phone traffic and chiseling out bits of information under this guise of international terrorism. And while that remains a big issue, what is the trade-off and what is the loss of that trade-off? You know, this show today on personal privacy, we get into a lot of other issues, and I want to give the call-in number so folks who want to get into this conversation can, and that's 800-313-9443. 800-313-9443 is the call-in number, and we're talking about technologies related to personal privacy. I want to go back for a moment to some of the things that have happened and sort of where the technology has changed. You know, making, you know, in the old days to find somebody, and it wasn't that long ago, 100 years ago, if you wanted to locate someone, you didn't pick up a telephone. You didn't pick up a radio. You didn't pick up any kind of modern communication device. You picked up a pen and a piece of paper, and you hoped that the letter made it through. Or you walked around town until you found your friend. And that's the way communications worked just 100 years ago. Today, virtually all communication is electronic. The letter is the rare thing. A piece of mail is, in terms of a personal communication, is indeed a rare thing. And at the same time, what that opens the door to is abuses of privacy, because all electronic transactions in terms of communications are, in fact, monitored. It's been monitored since the end of World War II, when the United States, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada actually made an agreement, and it resulted in the Echelon program, which many are aware of. And this is a mutual agreement between the countries to spy on their citizens or each other, because governments, these particular governments and ours expressly, cannot on a wholesale basis theoretically violate the privacy of everyone. So what the deal was is everybody would spy on everyone else's communications. Every agency within those governments that had a reason to know or a cause to know would load in what are called dictionaries, which are key phrases, words, or even voice prints, you know, like the few seconds of my voice loaded into the system. And what the system would do then is screen through by supercomputers massive amounts of communication, looking for those bits, those words, those phrases, those voice prints, that basic digitized information flowing through the internet, telephones, radios, communication networks, and literally pluck those communications out of that soup. And then those that were of interest that the computers couldn't fully analyze get routed to thousands of technicians that actually look at that data. And as computing power increases and computer sophistication of the programs to sort that data increases, the human element decreases and the cost decreases, and that's why this technology is moving so rapidly today. The biggest computers in the world today, in 1 second can compute what 6.6 billion people with hand calculators can do in 60 hours, in 1 second. And so these are the computers that are being used by these agencies to sort that kind of data. Now, on the private side, not using supercomputers, but systems much smaller, you get companies like CenterPoint and others that are essentially data warehouses. And this is where this phrase data valence coming out of European Parliament hearings comes from. And this is this idea of collection of data that allow you not the ability to racially profile, but profile against purchasing interests and personal habits, as well as political persuasion and political habits, even getting down to real fine definitions of who you are politically, so that, in fact, messages can be sent to you, political advertising can be sent to you and directed towards you that you're most likely to respond to in a positive way for some politician or somebody selling soap. But they'll deny you the 90% of the information you might need to make even a better decision. We're going to be back. The music is playing. If you want to call in, it's 800-313-9443. 800-313-9443. And this is Dr. Nick Begich, changing the way we see the world. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and it's Wednesday, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And today's topic that we're talking about is technologies and some of those invasive technologies related to personal privacy. If you want to get in on this conversation or add to the have comments or questions, you can call in at 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. Going back to this issue of personal privacy, there was a report. It actually goes back a while. It was an executive summary put out in September of 1998 called An Appraisal of the Technologies of Political Control by the Science and Technology Assessment Office of the European Parliament. And during those years, I was traveling quite a bit, actually, to Europe. I was working on a couple of other projects that were similarly related, technology-related issues with the Parliament. And this issue of personal privacy kept coming up. And the reason it was coming up in those days was that it turned out Echelon, this system used for monitoring all this communications traffic around the world, was being used by the United States not just for national security issues, but also being used commercially. Information was being given to U.S. companies to give them advantages on international contracts, utilizing essentially a data collection system set up by national security offices of the participating governments. What that resulted in the late 90s, we didn't hear much about it in the U.S. You know, this kind of stuff doesn't really make much of a splash here. I think there were a couple of little blips in the news media and it was gone. In Europe, it was a different deal. The Germans found out that some of the listening stations were on German soil. They shut them down and threw the U.S. government out as far as those listening stations were concerned. They resented the idea that all of their citizens' communications were being monitored. And then it was the French, because it was one of their companies that lost out on a huge contract to a U.S. competitor, and it turned out that information had been leaking or provided by Echelon monitoring systems and the related organizations to the U.S. government. You know, this is, you know, again, sort of this overlapping slop over of multinational corporations and the political control they assert in the United States through what we call campaign contributions, and in other countries they call bribery, because it gets you the same thing. You know, a contribution gets you access, influence, and outcomes. And that's bribery. It's just a nice way and politically correct way of talking about it today. You know, my family's been in politics over 50 years. My dad served in the Congress. He served in our state Senate. My younger brother's involved in politics here in Alaska as mayor of our largest city. And you know, when we look across historically, too much of our political outcomes have been driven by the very same companies that have vested interest and interest in developing and banking on the sale of high technologies. I mean, if you look at the biggest part of the U.S. economy in terms of national budgets, you can combine all the other departments together and it's defense-related expenditures. When you look at The technologies of political control, the ones the European Parliament is speaking about, and parliaments throughout Europe and the world are speaking about, legislatures around the world are concerned about, is this overreaching into personal privacy and how it might be used for national advantage. And it's not just the U.S. Consider the fact that our infrastructure is just as vulnerable to any other sophisticated government, whether it be the Chinese, or Cubans, or whoever, you know, or even terrorist organizations with the right level of sophistication could even hack through either any of our infrastructure, whether it be the information infrastructure, communications, energy structures, all of these things, and we're the most vulnerable there. In fact, for over a year, in a recent press report in the last couple weeks, they have been trying to recruit for Homeland Security the guy that'll run that infrastructure security for information technologies and communication technologies, and no one wants the job. And the reason no one wants the job is because whoever fills the job is already in a failing situation because that cannot be adequately safeguarded today. And yet, the need to safeguard that infrastructure is greater than it's ever been because the opportunity to penetrate it is greater than it's ever been. In another recent press report, you know, the Chinese actually hacked their way into the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States military's private computer systems, as well as the level of attacks on computer systems of our government ran into the few hundred just 7-8 years ago, and now runs into the hundreds of thousands of attempts and many successful attempts in any given year. That kind of hacking through secure systems starts to raise, you know, even bigger questions about, you know, what are the avenues, what are the possibilities, and the reality is, you know, all these systems, you know, they were going to put on the V chip. Many remember this, where they were going to be able to access everyone's personal computer and personal data, but of course they wouldn't turn it on without without a warrant. And then we find out about this administration's regard for warrants. You know, the reality is they'll violate the rules until they get caught. They'll think of excuses for why they're justified, and then they'll forget about the constitutional questions along the way and see them as somewhat irrelevant. The reality is these technologies have incredible possibilities, but at the same time, the temptation to misuse them is just great. I mean, when you think about commercial interests being able to profile a customer base so efficiently that it results in significant sales increases, would they do it? Of course they would. Coming back after the break, we'll get back into the technology issue, some of the commercial applications, and how that information is being used, and not necessarily in our own interest. This is Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World on the RBN Live Network. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we are talking about technologies. I have Carrie hanging on in Louisiana. Carrie, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you wanted to make a comment or ask a
question? Yeah, I mean, this whole NSA, AT&T spying, you know, giving all of our records to the NSA without a warrant, without a court approval, whatever, is just ridiculous.
Yeah, and, you know, there is a lawsuit actually pending on that one. And
is that the one you Studs Terkel?
I'm not sure who the plaintiffs are, but I know there's one that's moving forward. It's made it first through the first rung of the court,
well,
so hopefully it'll go there.
I read an article today from the Chicago Sun-Times that Studs Terkel and six other prominent Chicagoans were seeking to stop AT&T from sharing the customer's phone records with the U.S. government, but U.S. District Judge Matthew Kennelly dismissed the lawsuit filed by Studs Terkel and others, citing state secrets privilege designed to protect national security from being harmed by lawsuits. I'm reading from the article right now.
Right. There was an article filed, I believe it was in California. I might be incorrect on that. And within that court, I believe that it was accepted. I'd have to check and see, but I believe it was. And it's raised a lot of problems for NSA because it subjects them to a subpoena. And you know, this is, again, where we're right on that edge. You know, people, there was a really great quote back in 1997 or 96, and it was by Secretary of Defense William Cohen, and it was on terrorism, interestingly enough. And what he said is going into this century, the 21st century, that this press of security against privacy and personal liberty would be a real test for this century, for this generation. I think he's dead on right. And this is another example of why that test is out there.
Absolutely. But, I mean, you know, like you were talking about, Echelon and Carnivore have been gathering all of our whatever records we do of the Internet, cell phones, debit cards, credit cards since, what, the 70s at least?
Yeah, a lot of it goes back even further. I mean, data collection has gone a really a long way. You know, my dad was in the Congress during the early 70s, and that was when Hoover was tapping all the congressional phone lines and engaged in just, you know, all of that type of activity in those days. And they did it without warrants. They just did it randomly. And I'll give you a couple examples. 2020, my dad disappeared in a plane with the majority leader in 2020, was looking into this story at one point, and they had requested my father's FBI file, which was, you know, my brother was in Washington. He got a chance to see it, and, you know, it was like a little half-inch thick file, which is kind of what you'd expect for someone serving in the Congress anyway, because people do background checks in the course of your work. But my grandfather's file was an inch and a half thick, which,
wow,
I thought was really remarkable, considering he had an eighth-grade education, was an iron miner, you know, with pick and shovel, an immigrant from Yugoslavia in 1906. But it turned out that my grandfather worked for a social organization in Minnesota that was saving and collecting money and sending it over to revolutionaries in the former Yugoslavia when it was still under communist rule, and it was for the freedom fighters, and it created an inch and a half thick file. Now, you know, I mean, was my grandfather engaged in anything illegal? I don't think so. You know, he's sending money to democratic organizations in a communist country. You know, I don't think anybody find that objectionable in the United States, or at least I hope not. But the reality was, They felt the right to look at a guy that could barely speak clear English. Most people couldn't understand my grandfather when he talked. His accent was still so thick after, you know, 90 years almost in the United States. You know, but this idea of personal privacy and its invasions go back, way back. The thing is that it just bubbles up every once in a while. Then we start asking questions like this latest scandal with the NSA, but it's been going on for decades, and the results are tremendous amounts of information on each and every one of us now being able to be collected and collated. And why is it important? Well, a lot of the policies being evolved for weapons development and for security within the United States, for instance, the whole non-lethal weapons area gets it specialized when it's domestic, can be used for Department of Justice applications and overseas against declared enemies. So DOD and Department of Justice have a deal, and their deal is to develop on a priority basis these types of technologies. And the target under this DOD and Department of Justice briefing are for those against who are opposed to American policy. Well, that's everybody, because I think everybody's been opposed to American policy at least once.
Yeah, that's a major supermajority of the country right now.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
right. And so
what are they going to do? They're collecting way more information than they can even, you know, physically analyze.
Right now, that's true.
But they're going to use, what, computer programs to data mine it so they can get a list of dissenters?
Exactly.
They can start rounding us up and put us in these camps at Kellogg Brown and Rudy's building?
Well, they certainly have the database to do it, and that's the reality. It's, you don't have to sort it all in real time. You just have to be able to store it all. And once you've stored it all, you can always go backwards in time and take a look at someone, and then
yeah,
you can determine all kinds of things. So it may not be this administration or the next one or the next one, you know, but the Adolf Hitlers of the world rise up occasionally and make it to the top. And those are the guys that will utilize this. Those are the mindsets that will utilize this kind of information to maintain control and power. And the problem is the administration we have right now is of the mindset to retain for their corporate handlers control and power. And I think we've seen it, and we've been manipulated on the social issues, all of us. You know,
yeah,
every conservative has been manipulated by social issues to get us rounded up and rallied up on these candidates that then betray us on everything that affects our bread and butter every single day. And then they betray us on the social issues down the line when they're ready to end their careers anyway.
Well, exactly. I mean, because what they're going to do is they're going to vote for what's you know, what's going to get them reelected. And they're all bought and paid for, a bunch of whores we have for Congress, with a few exceptions, Ron Paul of Texas probably being one of them. But, AIPAC and all the special interest groups, they give to everybody. So everybody, all the Congress people are on the take. I mean, when's the last time you heard any congressional member, House or Senate, speak out against Israel?
It's not going to happen.
It ain't going to happen. And, you see Israel committing mass genocide of the Palestinians. They have a war of aggression against Lebanon that they're doing. Nobody's speaking out. And Condoleezza Rice is in this meeting, and she's vetoing any kind of compromise, any kind of ceasefire, because, the reason is we need a permanent ceasefire, and this one won't do it. So it just gives Israel license to just continue its bombing of citizens. I mean, I've seen some pictures from Lebanon. I have a few friends who were originally from Lebanon, and I mean, they're just outraged, and nobody's saying anything about Israel.
Well, if there's been a war on terror that's failed at since 1949, there's not been in anybody's imagination a ceasefire in Israel.
No.
And there won't be, and because people are never going to settle this issue and never be happy with a 2,000-year-old argument. And the problem with all of this is, really when you look at what's bringing us into the picture, it really has more to do, in my view, more to do with multinational resources. And, there's no, people say, we're worried about the oil. I don't think Brown and Root or Halliburton or any of those guys are worried about the oil at the moment on the basis that, hey, it's $70 a barrel plus. They're making money on the reality of a Middle Eastern meltdown, and not just a little bit of money, but more money than most governments in the world.
Absolutely. And, Exxon says, well, we're just maintaining a 10% bottom line. Nobody was crying for Exxon when oil was down to $11 a barrel.
No,
we're just maintaining our 10% bottom line. Yeah, but if you go from $11 a barrel to $70 a barrel, that 10% bottom line becomes record numbers.
Yeah, well, the other part of Exxon, seeing that you brought him up, is, there was an oil spill in my part of the world here in Alaska.
Yep.
15 years ago, and there's been a $5 billion judgment for 15 years that Exxon has fought, and we have people who have, about 7 or 8% of the people that had those claims are dead of old age now. A lot of them lost their, in our part of the world, agriculture is the fishing industry, and a lot of these people lost everything, and Exxon made that much money in 2 quarters to settle it. We've given them tax incentives during this period of time that have saved them 2, 3, 4 times that kind of money. And yet they won't even pay their bills. And, these are multinationals that have been able to influence political outcomes. We still don't know, and people have forgotten that. 4 years ago, people were asking for those reports on those meetings dealing with energy policy that Cheney was running at the White House. We still haven't seen them, and yet we've seen
state secrets.
Yeah, well, that resulted in that move from the $20 barrel in oil to $74 barrel in oil, for a barrel of oil.
Yep, and go ahead.
And it's just in this short span of this administration. When you talk about a transfer of wealth, the biggest transfer of wealth in the history of mankind has happened on this administration's watch to all his buddies in the oil industry. And anyone who is naive enough not to understand that needs to look at the money and the influence and who paid for this man's election and how much money was spent in that last presidential election. You think that money, $1 billion spent in elections, was for people's good faith in this government? It was to buy it. It was to own it. And it was to control its outcomes in the billions, trillions.
And you remember before the Iraq invasion, they were all talking about how the price of oil was just going to drop once the oil from Iraq started flowing. And what's happened? It's more than doubled.
Right. And here's another little misnomer. We may not like the government of Iraq, and I agree on that whole score, but it was a state-owned oil company. In other words, when you switched out the government, if you really switched into a democratic government, it still remained a state-owned oil company. The resource underlying the land, the energy, belonged to the people, just like it does in this country.
Right.
In this country, we lease it out, with the exception of some areas of Texas and then the East Coast, where the energy rights ran with the land. They don't in the western part of the United States. They're owned by the government and leased to the industries. Well, what do we do in Iraq? We privatized the industry. In other words, we went in there, we had a war, and we gave it away to the oil industry.
Yep.
Well, wait a minute. You know, there's something wrong with this picture. And the picture is, it belongs to the people of Iraq. Let them decide who they hand it off to. And if they want to lease it to the oil industry, go for it. But that's not American policy. That's their only asset to rebuild their country, and we hijacked it. Now our tax dollars are rebuilding that country.
Yeah, and a lot of the rebuilding efforts have stopped. They just, we're not going to rebuild anymore. Nah. And, you know, all these promises, it's only going to cost a few billion dollars, and the Iraq oil money is going to repay us, and it's going to be used to rebuild that country, and they're going to open us as freedom, whatever. We're going to grant them that freedom and all this other bull. And it's just, you know, the whole thing is just a mirror image of what they said it was going to be.
Yeah. You know, and really, you know, we train our guys in 12 weeks to go over and fight this war. And we've had, you know, a couple years there to train their people to have a country. And I think it's time to recognize that people have the country and the government that they want. And if they're if they want a revolution in Iraq because they can't agree on that, they're entitled to that.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, we may not like it, but they're entitled to it. If government truly springs from people, let them have their own revolution, you know,
and
just like we did.
Get out of there.
You know, and at the same time, what are our interests? And if we had spent what we spent in this war and in this conflict on alternative energy sources during the same time period, we wouldn't be sweating it.
Exactly.
And this is, again, a trade-off of what's important to the average American, not what's important to a multinational company that has no roots here anyway, anymore.
Yep.
All right. Well, Kerry, thanks for the call. You know, there's another point to energy that I want to raise. You know, this idea of the underlying oil being the people's oil, our oil. Here in Alaska, we kind of understood that. So during statehood, we were able to hold a certain amount of underlying resource. What people don't realize is that that underlying resource for Alaska actually fuels our economy. The oil field at Prudhoe Bay, which is on state land, 25% of all the revenue from that oil goes into what's called our permanent fund. In Alaska, we have 700,000 people and $30 billion in liquid assets in the bank. And that money generates a check for every Alaskan, about $1,000 a year this coming year. We don't pay a state income tax. We don't pay a state sales tax. We don't pay virtually any sales taxes as individuals or as corporations until you make over $250,000 a year, and the state gives you money.
Wow.
And it's a share of the underlying resource, and it's only 25% of what the state gets. But we bank the money, and now the money earns money, and so over a five-year floating average, it returns to the citizenry here a percentage of those earnings. And in order to change anything about that fund, it requires a vote of the people. Well, you know how people feel about being robbed, so
yes.
It's not changing.
Exactly.
And it's a non-political board, so it doesn't deal with – it has one of the best earnings of any fund of its size in the world. It earns anywhere from 8% to 13% a year in most years, which is phenomenal for a fund of that size. And, you know, this is – Alaska, that's one oil field. You know, we have more oil fields in Alaska that have yet to be opened up. We have coal. We have 32 of the 33 strategic minerals in mineable quantities, world-class mineable quantities, and yet most of it is unexplored and undeveloped, and partially because it represents the biggest safety deposit box for multinationals in the world. As they exploit the third world and get thrown out piecemeal by piecemeal, and you see it happening because they take advantage. They'll eventually be here, and they'll have this huge resource to take advantage of.
Yeah, going to try and rob the Alaskan people.
Well, you know, and the thing about here is, you know, this was the Lands Act going back to the 70s when my dad was in the Congress. They actually took out of public or out of the access to the public millions, hundreds of millions of acres. Before then, you and I could go out, make those discoveries of those valuable minerals, and as an American citizen lay claim to them. Under our mining laws. Today, they're locked up in parks and preserves, and the only way they'll be open in the future is a national emergency and only exclusively to the multinationals, not to you and I. So it was another banking hijacking. I mean, during the 80s, when all those fights were being played out and finally settled during the Carter administration, all the environmental groups were overjoyed that the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, or all these multi, all these trilateralist groups were funding the environmental movement, what they didn't know is it wasn't about the environment. It was about the safety deposit box called Alaska, where these resources would be exploited later exclusively by the multinationals who used the environmental movement as a way to make sure they got them into the safety deposit box. And that's exactly where they're at.
Unbelievable, but not surprising.
No, and, you know, my family's been involved in those debates for, you know, now since just before statehood, actually, and we've watched what's happened here. You know, statehood happened because of oil discovered in Cook Inlet. And you know, oil's driven this economy. It drives all the economies of the world. We're headed for the break. Kerry, thanks for calling in. That was a little off our topic today, but a good bit of information. I think people need to know that, and that's what this is about, changing the way we see the world with Dr. Nick Begich. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And pass the word on. This is we're going to be covering technologies every week. We'll start mixing in guests in coming weeks, but we've not run out of material, I guess, so we have a lot to cover yet. You know, the just before the break, we were talking a little bit about some of the things happening in Alaska in terms of how assets, national resources and state resources are handled, quite a bit different than a lot of places. I want to mention before we get to the top of the hour today that our research is provided by the Lay Institute, which is a Texas-based nonprofit corporation. You can take a look at our website for information on the Lay Institute, and it's layinstitute.org, O-R-G, and that is the source of our research support. In fact, many of the listeners are in Texas. This is an old Texas family, the founder of Lay Potato Chips later merged it with Frito-Lay, and Herman Lay was then chairman of PepsiCo in the early 80s up until his death. His daughter, Dorothy Lay, founded the institute to report and educate the public on technology areas. So we're pretty excited to be associated with them. I work as their executive director and as a member of the board. The other site I want to point listeners to is my commercial site. It's earthpulse.com, E-A-R-T-H-P-U-L-S-E, earthpulse.com. And we also have a toll-free number for EarthPulse, and it's 888-690-1277, 888-690-1277. And there's information on our books and publications. The books we're talking about today and the material that we're talking about today came from Earth Rising the Revolution and Earth Rising 2, and you can see those on our websites. You know, we've just finished up, I think, the ultimate issue of personal privacy really deals with the mind and what happens within the mind. We just sent to the printer a book called Controlling the Human Mind that gets into that subject, with over 300 source documents, and that'll be out in a couple of weeks, and so we'll come back to that topic in the coming weeks. You know, going back to the issue of personal privacy for a moment, you know, sort of where all this has gotten back in front of the public has been over the monitoring of phone calls. And, you know, that's pretty pretty routine situation, but, you know, those calls are already, records are already stored. Collecting information from those stored records is what data valence, as the European Parliament calls it, is all about. And, you know, what's interesting when you start to think about it, you know, one of the most surveyed populations in the world is in Great Britain. When you drive into London or you fly into London, I don't care how you get to London, from the time you arrive to the time you depart, your image is captured on so many cameras they can literally track your movements through the city. Your license plate is checked. You know, it's probably one of the most heavily monitored populations in the world. And yet, in Great Britain, for instance, computer programs with cameras scattered around the city can do several things. One is they can actually pick up gunshots, triangulate the position, and know exactly or approximately within a few meters where that gunshot came from. Conversations may be recorded in Great Britain as you're walking down the street. Many of the things that we take for granted as private are, in fact, not private any longer. We'll get back into that right after the top of the hour break, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to this Central Time, 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Every Wednesday we're on, so pass the word if you appreciate this program. If there's other issues you want us to cover in the future, please shoot us an email. You can do that at info@earthpulse.com, info@earthpulse.com. That'll come to me. Or you can take a look at RBN Live's website, and there's a link there that you can hook up onto our website and pass that information on. You know, the issue of technology, you know, for me, it's always been, you know, fascinating. Everybody is fascinated by what we've, you know, the gadgets and the devices that have come into our lives over the last 20, 30 years, and it's pretty amazing how fast all of this has changed. I mean, even the words we use today 10 years ago, you know, would have been like walking into another country. I mean, the internet, the websites, I mean, all the things that now drive so much commercial activity. And what people aren't recognizing is it also is the ease of data collection that these systems provide. And that collection of data and use of the data can be directed in very specific ways. You know, we were talking about this Department of Justice and Department of Defense protocol on non-lethal weapons, where they agreed that these would be developed on a priority basis and used against those that would oppose American policy. And what I find amazing about that and the way it's phrased is most international treaties, people don't realize, but most international treaties do not have domestic law that parallels them. In other words, when we passed the chemical and biological treaties during the Clinton administration and before, they had out language. The language they had said essentially, yeah, you can't use this against a declared enemy or any signatory to the agreement, but the fact is you can use it within your sovereign boundaries. That's how come in Russia, they were able to use a gas that would have been prohibited in an international conflict by their signing that treaty. They could use it domestically in a movie theater when Chechen rebels had taken hundreds of hostages, and they actually ended up killing with that gas over 100 of their own citizens. The reality is that is permitted under the treaty. And the language that permits it is almost mirrored in this DOD Department of Justice policy agreement. And I debated it in the European Parliament at one point, and we had a member of the International Red Cross who had analyzed the language in that international treaty and found it highly objectionable on the basis that, you know, hey, if you can't use this against your declared enemy and you live in a civil country, then you don't use it against your own citizen. And this out language has never been addressed within the United States. So you have situations where we've developed policy and yet it doesn't apply to our own citizens in terms of protection. We protect an adversary before we protect our own citizens under those conditions. When you start to look at who opposes American policy in the United States, well, in my list, that's every single human being, because somebody sometime in our lifetimes disagrees with what our government is doing about something. You know, that's just the way the American character truly is. And, you know, the idea that such a loose definition would drive weapons developments with our own money, you know, is a pretty blatant slap in our face. You know, the place where some of this was really being considered was just as we wrote Earth Rising and Revolution, 1999, the end of 99, there were huge economic protests in Seattle that united a whole bunch of diverse groups of people that felt like the World Trade Organization was the ultimate ripoff of the American public and, for that matter, the rest of the world in terms of its equity. The reality was, you know, huge demonstrations incited to riot and then the use of technologies that can, in fact, kill people. You know, the reality is, as the technology advances, the use of these systems will also advance. The collection of data against activist organizations will continue, and the misuse of data will continue unless we start to object. This is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we'll be right back right after the break. And you can call in at 800-313-9443. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to RBN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 1 p.m. up to 1 p.m. from 11 a.m. Central Time. And today's topic is technologies of political control or privacy-related technologies. And we started the last hour with a discussion about a new system for tracking license plates that's being deployed around the country. This is a system that's able to read 60 license plates a second, run them through a computer, and determine who's who and who's where. This is a technology that is expected to be deployed around the country, blanketing, in some instances, some cities. And before the break, we were talking about, at one point, London and Great Britain and the monitoring that goes on there. And you know, the way those systems work in Great Britain, you'll walk down the street, cameras will be observing you, and if you make certain aggressive movements, computer programs connected to those cameras will analyze those movements, and if they're considered aggressive by the computer or fit within certain protocols, that particular station, that particular camera will draw the attention of a technician. And what you'll see in the back of these cameras, you might have as many as a couple hundred cameras in one wall panel with one guy watching them from 200 locations throughout London. And the way those computer analogs work and support those cameras, it really narrows the amount of action an observer would need to pay attention to, whether it be the purse snatcher, you know, those things are observed and dispatch police, or whether it be the casual conversation someone might be having underneath one of the microphones also used in that system, because they use microphones for triangulating things like gunshots, for locating where that gunshot came from. You know, this type of technology, and there's a lot of discussion, and there's a lot more of it being deployed in major cities within the United States. At one point, mayor of a large U.S. city suggested that, you know, there was no presumption of privacy in a public place. Now, think about that for a minute. What are the public places? Let's see, all the national forests, all the national parks, all the roads, all the highways, all the federal buildings, all the post offices, and on and on and on. And I think quite to the contrary, in fact, I think we have a presumption of privacy everywhere within certain, of course, certain limits, obviously. But does the government have the right to randomly track the movements of its citizens? You know, it's a good question. I don't think they do. I don't think that's the government's business, quite frankly, unless they have what our country has always believed is probable cause. And here's what happens in the course of time. We start to think about these concepts, and we see in the media the occasional problem in terms of how people are addressed in the context of civil law. In other words, you know, take a look at the law, take a look at how the law is operating in the country, and, you know, we can ask ourselves some questions about justice when we start to look at the law. You know, do you have access to the courts? You know, they say you do, but you really don't unless you're rich and have a lot of money, because to access the courts costs a lot of money, whether it's a criminal issue or whether it's a civil issue. To address the issue of personal privacy and file a lawsuit in federal court, as some have done, and apparently one suit was dismissed. I think there's another suit pending. But, you know, that takes a lot of juice. You have to either have willing attorneys contributing the time, or you have to have some serious finances behind it. And the only organizations that seem to be carrying that flag don't necessarily represent conservative interests. Mainly just liberal interest, and it's not about freedom of the press. It's freedom to say whatever you want. And there's a misnomer in this, because being able to say what you want has everything to do with having a forum that allows it. And what's happened is we're seeing speech restricted. We're seeing our movements monitored, our communications monitored. And how is that information being used to maintain the existing political structure in terms of who's in control? The most unpopular guy since Richard Nixon, for exactly the same reasons, incidentally, when the conservatives are again betrayed by violations of our liberty and freedom. And you know, it's a case of technology now driving it to a level. I mean, what we know in the public domain, what we know about, is a fraction, a very small fraction, of the reality of what government can and does do. The monitoring of communications and not just international communications. You know, big argument there was if it goes across this political boundary of the United States, our geographic boundary of the United States, that somehow the Constitution is left at the doorstep. And I have never met an American that wasn't a bureaucrat, a real American that believed that. the Constitution travels with each of us, whether we're in the military, whether we're civilians, traveling around the world. You know, we hang on to that Constitution and what it means to us. Personal privacy and the fact that the United States is violating the privacy of its own citizens and being thrown out of places like Germany for violating the rights of theirs, you know, in terms of the Echelon program that we mentioned in the last hour. You know, a lot of these abuses of power lead to the conflicts that we're in. You know, when you start to think about, you know, who do you saddle up with as your allies? You know, in the early 80s, and we saddled up with Osama bin Laden when he was fighting the Russians or the Soviets at that point in Afghanistan. CIA went in, we trained the guy, we gave him knowledge and technology, and so much knowledge about our technology, we can't even find him now because he can evade us so efficiently. The fact is, oftentimes we find ourselves transferring technologies in ways that come back to bite us. You know, we've been transferring technologies to China. You think they're not monitoring their populations? You know, the Tiananmen Square riots were filmed with U.S.-made cameras that we exported there to make sure that they could collect all those freedom-fighting citizens up and put them in a gulag somewhere? Is that what America's about? I don't think so. Technologies, even on the most fundamental, rudimentary levels, can be misused. The biggest exporter of torture tools, electric batons, used all over the world, is the United States. No restriction on the exports, even to those countries where we know they're going to abuse and use these instruments in a way that would violate most American sense of values. You know, the reality is our government supports often the very agencies of death and destruction that most of us would find highly objectionable. And then the idea of using information that's collected with our tax dollars for commercial interest, which is what incensed the Europeans about Echelon and the spying on their citizens and their corporations back in the late 90s. And yet, you know, all those things kind of come and go in the news media. We never really link them together. But when you start to link the abuses together, you see that it's not just some accidental happenstance that one, you know, there's one instance of abuse. It's a continuing systemic problem that has existed long before the terrorist panic, long before the drug war panic, long before the Red Scare. It's a way to keep the population in fear so that we'll continue to give up those things that truly make us free. If you want to call in today, the call-in number is 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443, and we're talking about technologies. I want to go back to some of the things that were going on in terms of technology and the innovations in this area, going back again to the 90s. You know, when they started collecting data and starting to use data for commercial purposes by getting a really good profile of people, you know, what they found is that certain kinds of people do certain kinds of activities across large populations with a great deal of predictability. And the more information you collect, the more predictable are what individuals will do or how they'll act either politically or in their buying patterns or their social patterns. So how is that information used? From a political perspective, the way it's used is you can profile people. You then cross-reference those profiles of individual patterns, and companies are doing this. The big data valence companies, the companies that are collecting huge amounts of data, are now mining that data, using that data, organizing programs around that data so they can offer to political people running for election, hey, we can isolate everybody that's interested in this particular issue. So there's 50 issues on the plate. You talk about the one particular issue that each of those voters wants to hear about and exclude all the rest. Your opportunity to influence that election is much, much greater. But if the average voter had access to your position on all 50 issues, they might find that the other 49 they don't agree with, and they'd never vote for you in a million years. But they don't see the data. You target the audience, and this is the way it's done. On a very unsophisticated level, the way it used to be done, and still is in some communities, is there's polling that goes on during election seasons, usually around three issues, education, crime, and the economy, because those are the big three that everybody resonates to. People gather the data, get their information, and then they go door to door. They knock on the door. Hi, is Mr. Smith here? And they know Mr. Smith is a registered voter that they already polled and know what he thinks, and they feed him exactly what he wants to hear. Go down to the next door. Well, that gets pretty convincing, you know. It wins a lot of elections. But the sophistication of the data now is changing so that that data can be mined so finely and with such precision, if you have the money, that you can literally drive those outcomes within elections. And that's one of the ways in which this technology will be applied and is already being applied. When you think about election processes, there's been lots on the voter scams and the automation of voting systems. You know, there are some things that never should be automated. You know, filling out a ballot in a voting booth is something we should never automate beyond the punching out the hole and making sure it's a clean punch, because the fact of the matter is any of those systems can be tampered with. If the Joint Chiefs of Staff's personal computers, personal systems that they use at that high of a level can be invaded, believe me, no election system is going to be safe unless it stays a manual system. In Australia, when I was traveling and lecturing there a few years ago, they had just announced mandatory voting. Now, most people stop and react to that and say, what a great idea. Everybody has to vote. Right after the break, we'll tell you why that's a bad idea and the results of that in Australia, because that may someday be pushed down our throats here in this country. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we're talking about privacy-related technologies today. You're welcome to call in at 800-313-9443. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. We're here every Wednesday from 11 till 1 Central Time, and thank you for tuning in. If you want to call in today and get involved in this conversation, we still have another half an hour or so to go, and the number is 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443, and we're talking about the technologies of political control. This concept, again, going back to the European Parliament, you know, we had been involved in giving testimony and providing data back in the late 90s when these issues were being heavily debated in Europe, and we're able to get the studies initiated by the European Parliament Science and Technology Group, and they actually completed those studies. We report on them in Earth Rising 2. It's The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul. That's a book that James Roderick and myself, Dr. Nick Begich, had written back a number of years ago. You know, when you get into these issues, again, they tend to hit a little bubble and they disappear. But the issues don't go away. Just the media coverage of them does. You know, people move on to the next big story. What we've done over the years is we've gone back and pieced together the data. And so when we're quoting from books and quoting from our materials, Earth Rising Revolution actually has 650 sources quoted and footnoted, footnotes on every page. Earth Rising 2, 350 source documents are quoted there. You know, those source materials are things that really change the way we look at these issues. And what we found is by providing that kind of data, people have been able to make better decisions, informed decisions, and at the same time, gain a lot more knowledge about these technologies. You know, on the, we've been taking a lot of those source materials and loading them on the internet so they're available to people for research purposes, and it's free. And you can go to the Lay, it's called, www.layinstitute.org, and you can look on that site, and there's something called EPI Index, and it's the Earth Pulse Press Index, and it's my archives. And what we've done there is we've begun to load documents, summations of articles, and bibliographical references, so you can word search them on keywords like GPS, geographical positioning systems. You can look up microwave and see what references we have to that, or radio frequency energy, or non-lethal weapons, or any of the topics that we cover on these programs, and you'll see at least what we have loaded in the system at this point. We have about 20,000 records going into that system over the next couple of years, so a lot of material going in. Kind of watch that site, and if you want to sign up on that site, there's a sign up. We don't share it with anyone, but it allows us to communicate with folks and let them know what's going on in the course of our research. You know, when you start to look at technology areas, and this is one of the, you know, again, one of the big areas for the Institute has been to educate the public and to really pursue this more vigorously, because so much is happening so fast at this point in time that we really need a chance to sort of assess, you know, where are we and where are we going. And we need to start to look at the kind of law and regulation that we need to protect our civil liberties and our rights And really our way of life. You know, these technologies are certainly changing our way of life. They're not going to go away. But how they're used is always the double-edged sword. You know, whether a telephone is used for calling your friend or used by the NSA to monitor terrorist traffic, you know, they're both legitimate purposes under the right conditions. But we need to ask, what are those conditions in a technological world, and at what levels should those things be restricted? And how long should data be kept? I mean, as an example, you know, these data banks that are developed, you know, should they keep it for a year? Should they keep it for a lifetime? You know, these are all questions that regulation hasn't addressed. You know, the idea of privacy of medical records, you know, that's something that people consider pretty sacred, you know, in terms of what's going on with our health. You know, the only group that's protected right now, totally protected, within the federal government during the Clinton administration, were federal employees. He issued a federal executive order to protect that data from being used in, like, employment decisions and promotions and insurance questions, but only applied to federal employees. You know, the fact of the matter is, as data gets collected, and what is the ultimate data on an individual that can identify you? It's a DNA tag. Once you have the DNA profile of individual, there's a lot of information there. The kind of information, for instance, who are the compatible donors, you know, genetically compatible donors for organ transplants. Do you want someone to have that information about you? What if it's one of the big names in the world that needs your liver, you know? I mean, I don't want my information out there for any reason on that level. And yet that becomes the ultimate fingerprint. And if you've committed any crime in the country, you already have your DNA in a national data bank. What they're developing for police officers on the road is essentially the ability to do an instantaneous DNA analysis. In other words, take evidence from a crime scene, put it into a device in a squad car that gets relayed through terminals to computers that analyze that DNA against all the other DNA in the data bank. This is where the technology is headed. When you start to think about that, in Great Britain, another place where civil liberties are violated routinely, there they had a rape in a town of a few hundred men. So they got the DNA of everybody, and if you didn't, you know, you certainly must be guilty. Well, you know, this is all a way that, you know, people acquiesced and did it there, and they caught the rapist, and people said, hey, what a great idea. You know, there are some ideas that maybe aren't so great because that information can always be misused. We're going to be back right after the break. You can call in at 800-313-9443. And this is Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to RBN Live. We're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. And you can call in today at 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. You know, again, going back to the issue of technologies and privacy-related matters, you know, this idea of the ultimate ID, you know, DNA is often talked about, that information and the need for it in terms of medical uses is what's going to drive that one. And I'll give you a good example. There's a now there are companies in the country that can analyze a person's DNA, for instance, to look at everything in pharmacology, every kind of drug that's out there, and look at those drugs against your DNA to determine which ones you absolutely should not use and which ones might be very effective for you based on a DNA analysis and a genetic profile. You know, that's useful information. You know, in terms of looking at drug interactions, it's probably the cause of well over half of medical malpractice litigation and the deaths derived from medical malpractice. So, you know, by 2008, there's supposed to be on a system that's developed where all prescription drugs are analyzed for drug interactions. And the next step along that path will be looking at all those drug interactions against your individual DNA. And that's what's coming. Now, the other issue that comes up, and I heard it during the break on one of the ads, is discussion of implant technologies. And people have heard about this for decades. If you go back to 1989 at the U.S. Army War College, there was a publication called The Revolution of Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War. And the U.S. Army War College was talking within that document in one instance about implant technologies being used for service personnel, for military personnel, particularly special forces where they're already used, as well as heads of state, business travelers, you know, because it's a volatile world, they said in this paper. And of course, they wouldn't turn on a microcircuit to track a person unless, of course, there were a conflict. At least that's what they say. Personally, you know, I don't buy that, because if you really read this paper from the U.S. Army War College, you also read this articulation, this discussion about how we should give up civil liberties and freedoms and American values, but that we should do it in an environment of fear. In other words, what they said is, if they could whip up an environment of fear based on international terrorism and international drug trafficking, that's what the U.S. Army War College said in 1989 in that document, that they could, in fact, usher in a whole new class of weapons, including implant technologies, and people would basically accept it on the cry, you know, protect us, keep us safe, and accept this kind of technology. Now, why would anyone want something under their skin as the ultimate ID? You know what the biggest crime in America is today that's not prosecuted? It's identity theft. You know, you see it on the news all the time, and it whips up a lot of concern, and people get all excited, and then you see the abuses on the Internet that have taken place with phishing expeditions to try and hook you in to somebody's scam. And, you know, the reality is identity theft now is so epidemic that people are asking, the credit card companies in particular are asking for major changes so that they can get positive IDs. You know, they've already made it. You know, the credit card companies changed the bankruptcy laws to reinstitute involuntary servitude. You know, bankruptcy laws were set up for fresh starts, and now no one gets a fresh start for 5 years. They work under a court-ordered budget where the court says how much you get for medical and how much you get for groceries and how much you get for gasoline. And if the prices change, you better go back and get a court order, because you can't spend any more than that for 5 years, and all your excess income goes to your credit card companies. You know, these are the changes that have been lobbied by these companies. Now, their next big effort is going to be positive ID, because they're losing too much money. You know, you're not paying those losses ultimately. They are, and then you're paying them back at 18% or 20% interest on your cards. But these companies now have created their own form of money. Now, you think how much money is in circulation, dollar bills, currency. And compare it to credit card money, which is just another form of money that's created by banks, not created by even the illusion of the treasury. You know, and so when you start to think about what's happening in terms of why, what drives all this, it's mainly commercial interests driving the changes and fear driving our cooperation. Now, that's fundamentally flawed. You know, fear, I can tell you, when you look at the brain and people experiencing anxiety and fear and all these negative emotions, if you look at brain patterns under an EEG, and this is an area where I've spent a great deal of time, you know, looking at that technology, what you'll see is in those states of emotion, you cannot make good decisions. In fact, the whole system of the human being is set up with a flight or fight response into those conditions of fear. So it's not the kind of condition that lends itself to good thinking, clarity of thought, and eventually maybe good public policy that comes up from where it should, from the consent of the people in the appropriate way. If you look at people experiencing positive emotions, confidence, empathy, love, any of the higher emotions, you see very different brain patterns than an EEG. You see coherent brain patterns, the kind that lend themselves to good decision making. We are whipped up in fear constantly, fear of losing our identity, fear of someone taking our credit cards, fear of a terrorist. And we got a greater odds of a fear of your medical doctor. You know, terrorism in the last 10 years killed 5,000 people in the United States, including all of our citizens that we've lost in this so-called war. If you add that 5,000 people up in 10 years and compare it to medical malpractice, according to Harvard University, medical malpractice in the United States killed 1 million people in 10 years. We've got big problems in this country that can be resolved, that can be addressed. I mean, medical malpractice, half of that 1 million people that died was from drug interactions. We can analyze that today and know what drugs interact with you. Forget your genetic disposition, but how can you get that information, safeguard the public, and yet use that knowledge, use that technology to benefit us, and yet at the same time safeguard it? You don't do it with civil penalties when people abuse data. You do it with criminal penalties. You put people in jail for violating those foundational fundamental rights that made this country what it is, that allow us to have this democracy to try and get this democratic republic back, the tools for getting it back are being removed from us, a slice at a time. And at the same time, we're being left with a bag of fear and foolishness. You know, we're living in a society in the richest country in the world, and what we're seeing is a greater and greater division of those that work hard every day for a living and now working two and three jobs to make it work. And that isn't the way this country was built. The wealth is concentrating in the hands of multinationals that don't care one bit what happens on the big issues that affect our lives every day, as long as the cash keeps flowing. The fact is, the technologies of political control are also about commercial control, because greater markets are looked at all around the world. Multinationals use our government to create markets where maybe markets don't belong. You know, maybe our version of Western culture with MTV and all the garbage that we have here isn't wanted by other countries, certain other countries in the developing world. And what gives us the right to impose ourselves on them? And it breeds unrest, and usually it's about resource extraction. You know, you don't see us in the countries where there aren't any natural resources. You don't see us in Somalia today rescuing anyone. You don't see us in Ghana or any of the other places where hundreds of thousands have been massacred. If we truly believed that that was wrong and that was the expression of our public policy, we'd have been there. But it isn't. It's the expression of our public policy or those that have economic interests, and then they call those our American interests, and mostly they're multinationals that don't care. You know, here in Alaska, again, we have one of the biggest oil reserves in the country, and it's another prime example. You know, the Alaska Trans-Alaska oil pipeline that we have running through this state right now is engineered to handle 2 million barrels of oil a day, and it's running at half capacity. Half. And it used to run at 2 million barrels a day when it first cranked it up. And the fact is, it's running at half capacity, not because of a lack of oil on the North Slope, but why would you take oil out of the North Slope, which is more costly per barrel to produce, when you can go and exploit somewhere else in the world where it's less costly to produce? Of course you go there. Why would you not crank up the volume? Why would you crank up the volume on oil within the United States when it's $71 a barrel and you're already making more money than you ever made before? The fact is, if they cranked up that volume, they could solve some of our problems. The other thing that happened, and the reason they can't crank up the volume, is because of Asian demand for energy resources. There are not enough tankers to haul the oil around the world to meet the demand that exists today. That's one of the reasons the price is up. The reason gasoline is up at the pumps isn't because of a shortage of oil as much as it is a shortage of refining capacity to create those products that we need, whether it be gasoline, diesel, or what have you. And these are the things that are driving the problem. China's growing at 13% officially. India's growing at similar rates officially, and unofficially they're saying as much as 20% a year, you know, growth rates in these countries. If any of these predictions are true, it's the biggest industrial revolution the world has ever seen, and the results are increasing commodity prices, increasing huge increases in profits for multinationals, decreasing taxes, by the way, for multinationals because of all these trade agreements, and an increasing burden on the middle class of this country and every other country of the world, because we're not alone. You know, what often, as I travel, and I've traveled in the last 10 years to over 20 countries, I've gotten to know a lot of people around the world, and I can tell you, everyone is experiencing the same thing. You can use the power grid that you can... And you know, those changes that are taking place, all of those changes that are taking place around the world politically are being felt by everyone. And the same multinationals behind the scenes pulling the levers, whether it's Great Britain, Belgium, Germany, the United States. It's time to be an informed public and an active public. Europeans always look at Americans as we're the five minutes to midnight crowd. They know we're going to get involved, but they also know it's going to be probably at the last minute. But they also know the power of the American people to make change. Technology is what makes governments great in the 21st century. It's what makes our government great in the 21st century. But the values, the ethics that drive a great country have to drive that technology. The misuse, the abuse of technology that we're seeing today, whether it be monitoring phone calls or phone conversations without appropriate warrants, or whether it be the day when someone knocks on your door and collects up your guns, you know, these are the days that we're in today, and we don't need to wait for things to get desperate in this country. We don't need to respond to fear in reacting to these issues. What we do need to do is start lighting a fire under those that are supposed to be serving our interests. It's an election year. We ought to be getting involved in elections. You know, and I agree with people. You know, there's not a whole lot of candidates out there, but let's at least try and find them. And if we can't find them that are already running, let's look around our communities and start raising up some of those leaders that need that, maybe just need that encouragement. You know, you guys all know in every community, we all know in every community who those natural leaders are, and let's draw them out. Let's get them to start seeking higher office, and let's all engage in a little bit of political activity of our own, whether it be these issues that we're talking about today or any issue near and dear to your heart. If you want to call in today, the call-in number is 800-313-9443, and we're talking about privacy-related technologies today. And, you know, going back to Earth Rising the Revolution, back when we were dealing with a lot of things, these issues in Europe, and starting to see sort of how they shaped, this was pre-9/11, which is extremely important, because before 9/11, there was a different sense of these issues. You know, people were willing to take them on. Today, there's a little bit of reluctance to take some of these issues on because of fear of criticism, fear that somehow we're not working in the national interest. We need to ask ourselves, what are those national interests? And within democratic republics, there needs to be a higher level of transparency so we can see what's going on in government. Not transparency for the average citizen, because the real abuse isn't some individual driving down the highway having their mileage tracked. It's from abuses of power within government. And greater restrictions on access to information has happened in this administration than since the Nixon administration. After Richard Nixon, we had a huge change in the Congress in terms of privacy sentiment. And we instituted laws like the 1976 Freedom of Information Act, which allowed us access to data. Under this administration, classified materials have increased 3 to 4-fold. 300 to 400% more material is classified now than ever before under other administrations. And at the same time, the flow of information out, the restriction on information, has been constricted by about the same amount. In other words, a fraction of what we used to have access to, we have access to today. And that is not healthy. You know, in the Congress, and my dad was a congressman, served in the 92nd Congress. Congressmen aren't scientists. Scientists can't go into closed hearings unless they're invited. The select intelligence committees of the Congress have limited knowledge, quite frankly, to ask the right questions. And the greater amounts of knowledge and technology that are hidden, and the less public debate by informed people that can ask the right questions, means that we're going to continue to have really poor government, bad government, government that's fractionalized by not just special interests, but also by ignorance. Debate over the concepts needs to happen. We don't have to tell people how to build this stuff. We don't have to tell people how to invade someone's privacy or what technology are available to do it. But what we do need is that kind of rational debate to set in motion the type of regulations the 21st century demands by virtue of the fact that we're not driving the horse and buggy anymore. Information technology either creates transparency for the population or can create transparency for governments. We got an upside down equation, not just in this country, but all over the world. And it's based on, again, whose interests are served by control and concentration of power. And it's never the working person. It's never the little guy. It's only the elite, and it's always been that way. And it's the little guy that gets the chance to actually still pull that lever. And I was talking about mandatory voting in Australia at one point in the last segment. What they did there is they made it the law. Everybody votes at 18. If you don't vote, you don't have driving privileges. You pay more in taxes. You lose certain government benefits, so people vote. And everyone thought that was a great idea when only 20% were voting before. But the 20% that voted before were informed. They knew what the issues were. They weren't responding to a 30-second soundbite that a multinational could afford and you and I couldn't. The fact of the matter is, the 20% that were voting, you had a fighting chance when you only had to convince 10% plus one that you were right. Try and convince 51% of anything in Australia, and you better have millions and millions of dollars, and that money's only coming from one place, and isn't in $10 checks from average citizens. It's in $1,000 and $10,000 checks from multinational corporations. So what Australia did is create the what looks like democracy, mandatory voting. And in fact, it means that everyone will vote and most of the voters will be uninformed, responding to the 30-second soundbite and no information at all, just to keep their basic driving privileges. Take a look right after the top of the hour. We'll get back into this. If you want to call in, 800-313-9443. We've got just a few more minutes, and then we're off for the day. We'll be back next Wednesday. This is Dr. Nick Fegich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Fegich. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 till 1 Central Time. And we're talking about technology. We're talking about privacy technologies right before the break. And I was back on the subject of mandatory voting. So, you know, combine mandatory voting with electronic voting, and you can see the problems that happened from that. You know, and in talking to Australians about it, you know, on first blush, they all were sold this great idea that this was just great. Everybody was going to be participating. But participating and being informed are two different things. And the right to vote and the privilege to vote, which it truly is, it doesn't mean that the government forces you to vote, because that just breeds, again, bad government. You know, good government is driven by the people. You know, here in this country, the American Revolution, some have said, started with 6% of the people thinking it was a good idea. Never takes a majority. Any good idea usually started with a minority. Nothing jumps out of the status quo as revolutionary or convincing. And the kind of revolution which we need in this country aren't violent ones. In fact, they're just the opposite. They're revolutions in thinking and recognition that we are, in fact, powerful as individuals and we can make a difference. The fact is, every effort that is made to change the course of this country is an effort well made and not just in a vacuum. You know, you don't need an organization. You don't need to wait for some group to form. You're already in it. It's called the human race. We have an obligation to one another, an obligation to express ourselves as outward expressions of the Creator himself. And, you know, if we all believe that, if we truly believe that, we are powerful people with a lot behind us, and we need to start acting on what we need know to be right and true. You know, let's go back to the phones. We've got a couple callers hanging in, and we're down to the very last few minutes. Let's take Bruce in Omaha.
Hello, Dr. Nick. You talked about getting people to run for office that would be honorable and such and understand what's going on. They would be, once they got in office, they would be turned and controlled or else destroyed. Witness Jim Traficant, witness Paul Wellstone, and a few others. What we need is somebody walking around with a portable scalar weapon on his shoulder so that he can control these people that try to control him.
You know, I appreciate what you're saying, Bruce. And, you know, my dad served in public office. He died in public office, so yeah. Carrying out what he believed in. And I can tell you, you know, from someone that's lost someone who many believe was a champion, and if you look at the history, you'll find out our government betrayed him even in his loss, because yeah. They knew where he was. The reality is we still keep on fighting, you know, and the system turns a lot of politicians. I've seen a lot of my friends go from being really the kind of people you wanted in public office to the kind of people you wanted out. But I can't say we quit trying. We got to keep trying.
That's right. With one other quick point. So I was sitting here, excuse me, I was sitting here reading the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, new book by Joe Farrell. And talking about these scalar weapons, and it's beyond atomic weapons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I was into the section where he was talking about Gary Vassiliotis' companion's tome to the Secrets of Cold War Technology book.
Right, right. You're going to appreciate the one we've got coming out, Controlling the Human Mind. It'll be out in a couple of weeks. It's at the printers now.
Mm-hmm.
Over 300 source documents on this whole issue of really the ultimate issue of privacy, the mind itself. I hear the music coming up. We're out of time. Welcome to come back next week. And, Tom, call back in from Idaho. We'll take your call then. This is Dr. Nick Fegich. Changing the Way We See the World is the program, and you're listening to RBN Live.